From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Chernia.
And I'm Claire Wiley.
Well, this morning, our first guest will be Nate Brown. He's a local teacher here in Park City and an avian enthusiast.
Oh, I like that.
You like that?
Yeah. Well,
say a
well
birder,
said.
Say, no, avian enthusiast. And he's here. He's going to join us to specifically talk about the Audubon Christmas bird count that just occurred here in the county and all around the country.
Mm-hmm.
He'll give us maybe a summary of that event, what they observed, usual and unusual, hopefully. All of that in the first part of the show. Nate, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me.
All right. It's that time of the year. Every year we have the Audubon. Every year we have Christmas. Right?
Yes, and then this as well.
Oh, yeah, and this. Yes.
Did you know it started in 1900, Chris? This bird count?
Yes, sort of. I knew that. I knew it's been around for quite a while. And it was started as just like a family outing that people would, on Christmas Day, would, as an activity, go out and count birds and see how many birds they conserve. A little, you know, competition.
Yeah, it started in Europe and then made its way here. But 1900, it's 124 years.
Oh, well, let's see how this past year went. Go ahead, Nate.
Oddly enough, it actually started as a, it was a Christmas side hunt. So they would go kill birds.
Oh,
And then they flipped the script.
The gentleman, an ornithologist who actually ended up creating the Audubon magazine, decided let's go count birds instead of the original plan. So that's how the Christmas bird count started.
Well, of course, you know, John Audubon himself considered it a bad day if he didn't shoot at least a couple dozen birds. So they were just kind of following along in his footsteps, per se. But yes, now we just go out and literally count and observe them, hear them, I guess, Nate. And so,
yeah,
how did the Christmas bird count go here in Summit County?
It was a little bit of a quiet year, which, we never know, you know, oddly enough, probably the winter season is not the best time for counting birds, and you're just trying to get as many species as you can, as well as the numbers of birds. But it went well. It was cold, as the norm seems to be annually.
Mm-hmm.
But as you guys remember, it was 2 weeks ago, we were hitting 50 degrees or so in the day, and
right.
The water areas. The reservoirs and ponds and lakes hadn't frozen over yet. So we were able to get some species of birds that normally we probably wouldn't get in the winter time. So that was a little different. But all in all, we had a good group that went out. December 15th is our actual day. And the way it works is you just tally your mileage and areas you go to and species, and you get to count birds for a full 7 days, so 3 days before your actual count and 3 days after. And I think we ended up with about a little over 60 species, which is pretty good for this time of year.
60 species, and how many people participated? You know, give us an example of where you went.
We had a Swanner Nature Preserve hosted the day of, which was great, and we had, I'd say, about 15 people showed up, which was nice. And then other people just from around the community end up emailing or calling or texting and whatever they see throughout the count. It's a radius about 10 miles from a point that we pick in Park City. So Swanner's a great area. You get Summit Park out Bittner Ranch Road. Out to a little bit of Jordanelle Reservoir. Rockport Reservoir was a great location this year, since the water hadn't frozen over. A little bit of Wanship, and almost over to Peoa would count, Browns Canyon. So it's a good little region.
Okay. And like you say, water-based birds, upland species. Let's talk a little bit about what are the usuals? Some of the usual suspects, we'll call them, of those 60 species you saw, like the backyard varieties of. Hey, I'll start.
Yeah,
magpies and sparrows and finches, right?
Yeah, that's your good, like you said, backyard, and you get your mountain chickadees and black-cat chickadees. This year was, juncos. It was kind of interesting because there hadn't been any snow, really. So even, like, home and, backyard feeders, a lot of birds weren't even coming to kind of some general spots, like in your own backyard, just because they were able to kind of forage and feed on their own. But really nice to get down. Jeremy Ranch Road past the golf course is a nice, really nice area now with the creek there, which was flowing. So you can get your belted kingfisher. Mm. Can get, there's golden eagles are down there, bald eagles. The bald eagle, we got a good count of bald eagles this year from all over the area with the reservoirs. But you can get the Steller's Jay and your Scrub Jay are kind of your local birds in there as well. So you have your house finch, which is very common, but there's also Cassin's finch is a little different one that's been, we saw a bunch of those. And this year was kind of unique, like I said, with the reservoirs being not frozen over. There was a lot of waterfowl and gull species, which is considered rare for this time of year because they usually wouldn't be here with frozen over water.
And how many years have you been involved in this, Nate?
This is, I think, my 12th year up here in Park City.
So year over year, what are you seeing? Are there any things that you're seeing where you see a decline
trends
trends that you've seen over the course of those 12 years?
That's a good question because you do see, it really does vary on the weather conditions and how cold it is. But we're starting to find just regular locations in the area that you can kind of count on seeing specific species. So that's been sort of a pattern. There's a down in Wanship and the area by Rockport, there's a kind of a family or group of jays called pinion jays, which are normally pretty rare, but they're consistently down there. There's a nesting woodpecker. It's called a Lewis's woodpecker. Which we traditionally get, you get northern flickers or a hairy or downy woodpecker, very common around Park City. And there's been kind of a little colony of Lewis's woodpeckers over in the Bittner Ranch area, which is pretty cool. They're a really nice looking bird. It really depends this in the winter on the weather for what we see in here.
Right, and as you know, obviously in a warming world, maybe we may see some species, not necessarily spending all year, but maybe they're going to start visiting here, and maybe hanging around a little longer. Like the first one that comes to mind are the species of hummingbirds. I know we're off winter, but species of hummingbirds that might arrive a little earlier, stay a little later, and maybe some new species. Varieties of hummingbirds or upland species like that, Nate?
Yeah, it's very possible. The migration patterns are pretty unique. I kind of always say, when is the season? How do birds really know when to go north and south? It's not like they're getting weather reports when they're in South America the snow is gone in Park City, let's say, or vice versa. So it's weather, though, if there's tropical storms or crazy winds, it throws off birds, and that's when you get, rarities or variants that end up in Utah or anywhere else in the country. That's always unique to see what's showing up, but we're we're pretty good in this mountain area to get your consistent species. And even when you get up into the Uintas, there's a very unique like a variety of birds that can only kind of be seen around these parts at this altitude, which is really cool. Yeah.
Okay. If you just joined us, we're speaking with Nate Brown. He's a local Park Cityite, and we're talking about the Audubon Christmas bird count that was held around December 15th, plus or minus 3 days on either side. So basically, it's a full week of going out and observing and documenting. Now, can documentation be obviously a visual observation, but can it also be just be an audible observation?
And yeah, does that definitely.
Count? Okay.
Definitely. Yeah. And so that's where you get like your nocturnal species, your owls. Usually don't see owls. You hear them. And so, gosh, we got, yeah, great horned owls are pretty common right now. Mm-hmm. And I wish we could count owl pellets, because we had a location where there was probably a barn owl, which is a pretty unique and rare bird for this this altitude in this area. But there's obviously a lot of agriculture and farming fields and barns around, so they're out there. And
I'm sorry, Nate. And they have a unique pellet that separates them from other owls.
Or just knowing the location of where they have maybe been seen.
Okay.
And there's not, don't really get a lot of owl species at this area, altitude and climate. So, and they're very seasonal as well. There was a barn. So we kind of calculated that one out pretty easily.
Barn owl. What else? What
other? Yeah, there you go.
No self-respecting barn owl would be anywhere else around. But real quick, the great horned owl, is that its call? If I hear an owl at night, is that the classic hoot 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 call?
Yeah, it's definitely. Okay. I actually heard one, woke me up about 3 a.m. the other night. So yeah. And they're a large owl if you get to see one, and
yes,
pretty common all over this area. And they'll nest and have three or four babies at a time, and owlets, and they're pretty. They're nice looking bird, but yeah, that is your common 4 to 5 toot owl call you hear. So
okay,
not to be mistaken with a daytime doves are what people think they hear all the time.
Oh my God! Oh, I see. They hear the cooing of a dove.
Yeah, and they're like, oh, I heard an owl, and that's, well, they're not doing that during the day usually. So,
thank you.
So, yeah. With the Audubon Christmas bird count, there are, as I understand it, more than 2,000 active circles of this. How many are here in Utah?
I'm going to say just off the top of my head, there are probably 20 different Christmas bird counts throughout the state. From Ogden to St. George and all areas. It's, kind of funny. We probably have the lowest count just based on the region and the area we live in and the climate and the mountains. So, but it's a nice day to get out, to get, like I said, this folks over at Swanner host a little breakfast and coffee, and we get together, and then we divvy up what areas we're going to go see, and then report back at the end of the day. And then people are really kind and nice to send in lists, or they'll funnel everything back to me, what they've seen before or after as well, so we can get a full list. And then there's a submission program. So it's just kind of a nice little day to get to see people and meet new people. And there's always some people learning how to bird and where to go. So that's fun to introduce people to new places and different species.
Yeah. And it's one of the largest citizen science collectives that are out there.
Right.
And So do you have to have any kind of background to do this? What is there any threshold to be part of this?
Absolutely none. So that's the beauty. Like I said, it's always fun. It encouraged new people to, it's kind of a forum to get to see how birding works and where to go and what to see and characteristics of listening to birds or flight patterns. And there's some new novice folks, and I kind of get people interested in just the hobby and what it is. And otherwise you're kind of doing these things on your own, and it definitely helps to have some people teach you and guide you a little bit if that's something you're interested in.
And how robust is the community here for birders?
It's a pretty small community in general. Utah, the state, however, is pretty abundant in the sense that with the variety of geography and the landscape of the state, it's you got the desert in the south and mountain regions and then massive waterways, and it's a really good state for birding and species in general. So there's quite a bit of interest around the state, and it's slowly working its way, I think, up to Park City. So well, I was interested in having more. The more eyes and binoculars and ears you can get out there just enhances what species and what you can potentially get around here.
Now, obviously, you know, Nate, it's great that, you know, anyone can participate, and it's a great kind of gateway for kids to get involved in not just birding, but in the environment in general. But somebody's got to do some vetting too, and making sure that, you know, some person who says, I'm positive I saw an elegant trogon in my backyard,
yeah,
you know, somebody's got to say, I don't think you saw an elegant trogon. Maybe it was a magpie. So there is some review, QA, QC that goes on, right?
Yeah. And, you know, like it's a really cool process. What's kind of happened? There's Cornell University and their ornithology program has created a database. It's a free. Anyone can sign up. Anyone can use it. It's called eBird, and that seems to be it's a listing site. You can put checkpoints in. You can count your birds, list and submit. You can keep your own personal tallies for what you've seen in a day, a year, a county, a city, whatever you'd like. And that's sort of like a general you know, way that the data has, and it's a database really. So you can, you know, say you're going on vacation or you want to see what's being found in, say, Arizona tomorrow, you can look up a map or species, and they have reviewers, and so that's kind of how it's policed a little bit. That's a good point. It is, when you're novice or new to birding, it is a challenge to correctly identify some species, and there's certainly you know, if you say that you had a trogon here in Park City, you'd have 200 people at your backyard trying to see it. Otherwise,
that's
it would be
right.
Interested. So,
yeah, it would be on everybody's hot list. Red
and
alert.
People use social media to tell you what they've seen, and there's a lot of regulating that goes on there as well. Nowadays, you got to have a recording or a photo pretty much of something unique and rare to verify. Is sort of how the system works.
And you can also use apps like Merlin to help identify or confirm.
Definitely. Yeah. Merlin, that's this eBird Cornell system. And that's a great one. You can actually open it up and hit a button that just is listening to what's out there. And it's really accurate if you're out hiking or anywhere where you're hearing birds chirping or hoots or whatever, and it tells you right there to a pretty high percentage of what you're hearing. And you can also submit photos to it that you've taken or screenshotted or whatever's on your camera and your view, and they're really good resources for helping learn and identify birds.
Yeah, for example, I'm just looking at my list. Back in August, I was out wandering around looking for a Western tanager, hopefully. I didn't see it, but my Merlin said I heard one. So that was some consolation. Merlin's great like that.
It's really, it has come a long way even in the last year.
Yeah.
I think it was at I'm guesstimating, but it was probably 50% accurate a couple years ago, and now it's much better than that. Yeah, I remember people going, well, I'm seeing some bird species, and you're like, well, that's only in Colombia you can get that one, but maybe it's in your backyard, I'm not sure.
Right, and that's the nature of birders too. They really want to see a lifeless type bird, and they have to kind of temper their enthusiasm sometimes that way. So Nate, just a couple more minutes. Is there a summertime version of the Christmas bird? Like, should we have one around July 4th so we can capture summertime species?
I would say yes, and they have some other official a big day count would be, and I believe that's in May. Summer would be much more convenient for where we live, we're freezing every day we do it. I think we've had like the coldest temperatures every time we do the bird count.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're going to get much better count and visuals of birds than you would in the winter. That's, especially in North America with the weather we get. But
right.
We always kind of joke that, why are we doing this when it's 15 degrees out and there's a blizzard half the time? But it's kind of a traditional thing. And, I think Claire said, it's a census, it's a database that's how it originally started, was to just track and see what's out there. And technology has certainly helped and come a long way to aid in those types of, seeing, seasonal birds and, these checklists and the resources that are out there. They'll tell you what's in season, what's out of season, what would be considered rare, just as you're putting in a count, let's say. So that helps you kind of maybe narrow down what you think you saw or heard as well.
And real quick, speaking of not rare, but maybe unusual, please confirm for my neighbors and friends who don't believe me that there are a variety of pelicans that are out here.
We do get the American white pelican.
American white pelican.
Which, geez, you can see them. Some of the golf courses around Park City, and then the reservoirs, usually in the warmer months, for sure.
Yes, and when they're soaring, they're spectacular because
it's supposed to be a good omen too.
And snow white, is that a good omen too?
Yeah, they're pretty cool. I know. I see them when it's in season. They're always in the kind of the park meadows area, and they're huge, flying around and take their time getting down to the water around the golf courses usually.
All right. Well, Nate, we gotta wrap up. Of course, if people want to learn more about Christmas bird count, I'm sure they can do a search on that and go to the Audubon website to learn more about how they can get involved. And as always, we thank you for taking the time to join us this morning on This Green Earth.
Well, thanks for having me, guys.
Thanks, Nate. Have a great day.
Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about our relationships with and impacts upon the environment. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley. And our first guest we're excited to have on, it is John Marsluff, who is a professor emeritus of wildlife science at the University of Washington and an ornithologist. And John, thank you so much for joining us on the show this morning.
My pleasure, Claire and Chris.
Great. Well, first off, John, you are a professor and an ornithologist. Can you break down a little bit of what an ornithologist is and tell us about yourself and what led you into this profession?
Sure. An ornithologist studies birds. And in particular, I study the relationship of birds to people, either responding negatively to our activities like logging or recreation in some of our more pristine lands, or positively to the supplements we put out on the land. Some of our waste products are used by birds like ravens. And their interrelationship with people, very close coevolution with the behavior of some species that live in our cities, with people that live there and either treat them positively or negatively.
And you have penned a new book called The Gifts of the Crow, How Perception, Emotion, and Thought Allow Smart Birds to Behave Like Humans. And in it, you kind of break down the family of corvids, which includes crows, ravens, and also blue jays. Can you tell us about this family of birds?
Sure. It's a quite a diverse family of songbirds. The raven, actually, the largest member of that family, is the largest songbird in the world. But it includes the jays, nutcrackers as well. You have Clark's Nutcrackers up in Park City, magpies. There's about 150 species worldwide, and they live on all continents except Antarctica.
And I think people are very familiar with magpies here in our community. And I think
it's, unfortunately.
Oh, poor magpies. Now, they do get a bad rap here, but I think it's because of what you will describe for us. They are a bit of a scavenger, but they also, people talk about them teasing their animals, but you maybe describe it a little bit differently than teasing. They do interact with other species of animals. So can you kind of break down some of the interesting attributes that this family of birds, corvids, have?
Yeah, first off, they're very generalist, so they can take advantage of lots of different situations. Mm-hmm. The things we build, the foods we put out, they can make do with whatever we're doing to the environment. Some species do a lot better around us, like crows and magpies and ravens even, and others shy away from us, like some of the more tropical jays and even species that are highly endangered, like the Mariana crow and the Hawaiian crow. But they all share, in addition to this generality, they share a large brain for their body size, much more on par with primates than with other birds. So they also have extremely densely packed neurons in their brain. So they can solve problems. They use insight to solve problems. They remember details of things that happened when and use that to go about their daily lives. Most of them are social to some extent, so they learn from one another as well as through their own experiences.
Yeah, you describe these birds as being able to, like you say, think, but also to actually plan and even reconsider their actions. Go into a little bit about how they plan and how, as a scientist, you observe that or determine that.
Yeah, it's extremely difficult to determine some of these higher cognitive functions because, unfortunately, we can't have a conversation with these birds like we can with one another. But for planning, for example, you see some rudimentary sorts of planning that's probably not involving a lot of thought when these animals cache food. They often, when they have surplus, will store it in the ground or in the trees for later use. And that can be very hardwired, very robotic of a behavior. But they do know where they put things. They remember where they put things by forming connections in the part of their brain that we would use to form such memories, and that's their hippocampus. And we know that this organ, or this part of the brain, I should say, increases when animals are learning new things and storing food, for example. That's been demonstrated in chickadees and Clark's nutcrackers. And it shrinks as they retrieve and do away with those memories, retrieve those caches and kind of cancel out that information. So to some extent, that planning involves an important cognitive process, memorizing the location. Down to the inch where they put these seeds in the ground and recover hundreds of thousands of them throughout the year, the nutcracker does.
And
there's another really interesting experiment on planning that shows it even better, and that was using some scrub jays in England. And the researchers there allowed scrub jays to enter a couple of different parts of their cage. Some parts they would always have food in the morning and some parts they wouldn't. And when they entered when they had the opportunity to store food in those places, they didn't store it in the places where they always got food in the morning, but instead they stored it in the places where they didn't get food. So they were cognizant of reward coming in the future and planning where to put food to be able to take advantage or the advantage of the lack of that reward in some situations.
And you have some humid and corvid interaction stories, and one involves Dick Cheney in a way. Can you tell us this story?
Sure. You know, sometimes you do these experiments that you don't expect anybody to pay attention to, and this one has gotten a lot of attention. But we always were kind of felt like after we handled the birds we were studying to tag them so that we could identify them later or go to their nest to monitor their productivity, that they kept an eye on us and they responded differently to us after we had had such an encounter with them. So we did an experiment where we captured 7 birds on our university campus, and we captured them wearing a caveman mask so that we thought, well, that'll be neat. We'll walk around later and we'll wear that mask and see if they respond and compare that response to either us wearing no mask or wearing a control mask, which we wanted to be similar to the caveman. So we selected Dick Cheney, who was the vice president at the time. And this was 17 years ago when we caught these birds. And I can report that as of last week, there were still responses to the caveman mask, who is the perceived dangerous mask, dangerous person, and not to the Dick Cheney mask. So the birds now that we had initially captured with that caveman mask are all dead. None of them are on our campus. The last one died last year. She was at least 19 years old. But they have continued to respond strongly throughout our experiment, suggesting that information about this dangerous new person that walks around every once in a while, once a year, that this information has been transferred socially as others see other crows scold, is what they do. They scold and mob us when we wear that caveman mask. And this information really sticks with any other crow that seems to see it. And they carry this with them and trust, basically, that this person was dangerous and therefore I'm going to make sure I alert all of the other crows to his presence whenever he comes out on campus.
So they have ability to pass on information, otherwise educate younger broods about, in this case, this caveman mask, this danger, let's call it. Is that different from other non-corvids?
No, other social birds often learn from one another.
Right.
That's one of the advantages of being social. I mean, we do it to the extreme. But corvids are good at it because they often are in social groups and they often collectively gather to either spend the night where they could learn from one another about resources available or to harass danger, where they can be learning from this activity about a new danger or the occurrence or location of a particular danger. So they're ideally set up to do this, but other social birds do as well.
We're speaking with John Marsloff. He's professor emeritus of wildlife science at the University of Washington and the author of the book Gifts of the Crow, How Perception, Emotion, and Thought Allow Smart Birds to Behave Like Humans. So let's talk about their literal verbal language. All birds have, well, I guess some people would argue whether it's a form of language or just a form of communication. But talk about the corvid's ability to communicate with each other. And is that at a higher level than other birds?
Yeah, I think it is at a higher level. Their communication to us sounds like noise,
right?
More than a pretty song, right? For the most part, they croak or caw or rattle. But each of those sorts of utterances have important meanings. And we are just beginning to understand what those meanings are. My wife, Colleen, and I studied ravens in Maine many years ago, and we had captive ravens that we knew and recorded all of their vocalizations under various situations. And we learned that a given call has a lot of different meanings depending on who gives it, when it's given, what the circumstances are around that utterance. So there's a ton of complexity in these calls. And so you hear one thing and you think, oh, what does that rattle mean, for example? Like this morning, I stepped out of my house and a raven was rattling to me and I rattled back to her and we kind of went back and forth and she took off cawing. And it's like, you know, I don't know if she really responded to me or what she was really saying. I think she was just kind of an excited state, but I don't know what it was that excited her and what other information might have been conveyed. Her identity, her position, lots of other things like that are conveyed in these calls.
And perhaps over time, as they learn to adapt to, let's say, different ecological settings, like you say, they can adapt. They live in rural settings, but they maybe adapt to suburban settings and, of course, urban settings. Is it possible that there's different languages, a different set of communication, depending on what setting they're in?
I don't know if it's so much the setting that's possible. I mean, we know that the sound environment kind of influences the frequency of calls, the strength of the call, maybe the tone of the call, so that it penetrates forested areas, for example, better than open areas. So some of that could certainly inform the structure of the call, and it could sound a little different. There could also be, I think, more likely individual differences. And I think a lot of these birds, because they are long-lived, you know, like I said, that one crow, 19 years, that's up there for sure for these birds. But still, they develop nuances and idiosyncratic behaviors throughout their lives. And some of those are vocalizations. So you might have one bird that sneezes, kind of a sneezing-like call all the time. Another one that gives a particular kind of sound, like dripping water or a barking dog. And they might use that to, again, convey their presence, their identity to their lifelong mate or to others that are around their territory.
You mentioned that one crow lived for 19 years. Is that is there an average or range of lifespan? And do they pair up and mate for life?
I mean, most young birds die either in the nest or shortly thereafter. But once they make it for the first year or so of life, then, yeah, I think you could expect a typical age somewhere between 5 and 10 years. They are preyed upon by owls and golden eagles and things like that. Mm. And, of course, they're shot in many places by people. So their lifespans are cut short in that way. But I think somewhere around 20 years for a crow or magpie, maybe up to 30 for a raven, is kind of the max that we typically see in the wild. You have lots of variation around that, but that would be kind of the maximum. And they do pair for life. All the corvids form very strong pair bonds. And typically those pairs defend a territory, and often the birds that aren't paired kind of are vagrant and move over large areas without defending space.
And now they are omnivores, correct? And so maybe speak to that, and also what direct effects on their environment, or how do they interact with their environment, and how do they affect the environment?
They are omnivores, eating everything from insects in bison patties and cow patties to catching small rodents, even ground squirrel-sized rodents and snakes and things like that. To eating vegetable matter, grains. They are scavengers, as we mentioned earlier, on dead animals. And so their influence on their environment is first and foremost as scavengers, that they basically clean up the leftovers that are killed by predators or by our vehicles. They also are very important dispersers of seeds. The Clark's Nutcracker, for example, is responsible for dispersing whitebark pine, which we know is endangered at this time, and doesn't move around in its environment without a bird to gather its large wingless seeds and plant them in the ground some distance away from the parent tree. They also, being predators and being generalist predators, can affect other species through predation. And some of those are rare species like the desert tortoise or the sage grouse. In which case, the incidental predation on their chicks or eggs or young by ravens, for example, can be another threat to that species.
And then if we move into the actual title of your book, The Gifts of the Crow, can you talk about the actual gifting acts that you've seen in crows?
Yeah, it's kind of a wild behavior. And I remember when I first was contacted by a man who was feeding crows in his yard, I was pretty skeptical of it. He said that he fed these birds every day and asked them once, "Hey, I feed you all the time. Why don't you give me something back?" And he found this candy conversation Valentine heart on his feeder later that day that had the word love on it. Oh. And it was like, "Oh, this is crazy. There's no way birds right. are doing this." But we checked it out, and indeed, that was really the only explanation. And he had some other gifts, little bits of cement or pine cones and things that were on his feeder after the crows had been there. And then once we kind of publicized that, we started getting all kinds of images from people that have had things left typically at their feeding station or perhaps in a very conspicuous place after they've done something good to the bird. Like one man would put mice out for magpies on a barrel in his shed, and then on that barrel would be shiny things, you know, after the magpies took the mice. Another woman freed a crow from the fence, and then a crow started bringing her gifts, like, you know, the head of a shrew or a baby bird's body, kind of more the typical bonding sort of exchange right. you might expect between two corvids now seem to be going on between a corvid and a person.
Well, so somewhat could be interpreted as a measure of kind of thankfulness or gratitude, which leads me to a text I got, a person asking whether or not birds like these, crows and ravens and other corvids, can actually express measures of empathy or sympathy within their social order?
Yeah, it's possible. There are some experiments done in Austria that demonstrated in a captive group where you could see this. Again, to see this in the wild would be extremely tough. Hmm. But in a captive situation, after individual ravens and jackdaws got in skirmishes, they would then, the losers would be consoled by other members of that group, and they go over there and preen them, where they take their beaks and run them through their feathers to remove lice, and it's kind of a soothing bonding sort of behavior. So there's some evidence of that in these more controlled situations where individuals might have formed strong bonds with all the members of a group. To see that in the wild, as I said, is hard to do, but it's certainly possibly occurring.
Yeah, and the closest example I have, or anecdote I have, is a magpie that had died that recently passed, and of course a number of other magpies were in the trees around it calling or so, but then a couple came down and actually landed near the magpie, the dead magpie, and maybe even like brushed up against it or I don't know, otherwise poked it or so. I don't know if that, what you know, obviously they recognize something is wrong, but is there something more to it than just that?
There are reports from Colorado of magpies actually bringing sticks and putting them around a dead magpie like that. We did a lot of experiments. Kaylee Swift and I did experiments on crows in this funeral behavior, and we laid out taxidermied crows that looked dead. And we recorded behaviors of the birds, and they're extremely stimulated by the sight of a dead bird like that. They will gather. We showed through experiments and through brain imaging research that one of the aspects of this is the formation of memory and learning about a novel situation where it is extremely dangerous. So learning about the place and the person involved with this dead crow is all done, and stimulates, again, activity in the hippocampus of the bird, not activity in the amygdala, where you would think it would be if it was an extremely emotional response. So it's still possible that, again, these lifelong mates, when they lose one of those individuals, that there might be a very empathetic response when that mate of an individual who might have been with it for 10 or 15 years sees that individual dead. We weren't able to show that in an experimental way yet.
Okay.
Well, it's all very fascinating, and hopefully we use the word empathy now when we are approaching the magpies that are in our lives.
I say unfortunate with respect to magpies just because I'm not a big fan of their call.
Oh, well, I
love blue jays' calls and scrub jays' calls.
But you can't be a corvid elitist
I'm just being overly judgmental with respect to their call, Professor.
So I
love
think,
your magpies.
Yeah, okay. Love your magpies. I think it's a good message overall to love those animals around us. But thank you so much, John. It's super interesting read. It's called Gifts of the Crow, How Perception, Emotion, and Thought Allow Smart Birds to Behave Like Humans. And where can people go to find more information about you and to get this book?
You can get the book through any of the online resources or in a lot of bookstores. You can find out more about our work at the Avian Conservation Laboratory at the University of Washington. Hmm. Our website has links to a lot of the primary research we've done and a little bit about us.
Well, great. John Marsloff, Professor Emeritus of Wildlife Science at the University of Washington and an ornithologist himself, thank you so much for being on the show with us this morning.
Thanks, John.
My pleasure.